Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Shit Show with J-Bo. You are tuning into an awesome episode with a guy named Bradley Sweek. And he's in a real cool band called The Young Pioneers. They're putting out a record on K Records called High Again. I would highly recommend it. It's very eclectic, very cool, with a very strong pop song sensibility. Pop sensibility, as it were. The melodies are fantastic. Now, this band started back in the early 80s. And they reunited in the last couple years and decided to put out a new record, or maybe their first full length. Anyway, very cool. A ton of amazing history with this band, and Bradley in particular. Because that's who I talked to today. And no, I didn't talk to him today. Today is Christmas. I'm getting to this way later than I should have. But we talk about Greg Sage. We talk about Shannon Perry, you know, the local artist, singer in Gazebos. Greg Sage is in the Wipers. We talk about Fred Cole, Calvin Johnson. It's just a very cool interview. And I knew from the first moment that he started talking, it was going to be a good one, because he talked slow, and it wasn't that he talked slow, but it was more like you could understand what he was saying, you know. It wasn't going to be like a hyper, skippy, jumping around, neurotic interview. It was going to be cool. This guy knows his shit. I guess he also builds amplifiers, which is very cool, which we didn't get into in the interview, but he told me about that later, and they're amazing. People like Lisa Prank use his amplifiers. Anyway, dig the interview. I had a great time. We recorded it a couple weeks ago in December, basically, of 2016 at the Panama Hotel, which is an amazing tea house in Seattle. All right, I'll talk to you guys later. This is The Shit Show with J-Bo. Have a great one. Here's my theme song.
Welcome to the shit show, baby. Welcome to the shit show, baby. Welcome to the shit show. I know you feel at home. We got love on all things magic. We got love on all things tragic. We got love on the whole thing. I know you feel at home.
But tell me what band you're in and what you do in that band.
I am in the Young Pioneers, mm-hmm. And I am a guitar player, mm-hmm. And Chris Pugh and I write most of all the material that we do.
And Chris Pugh is the singer.
He's the singer. Is that right? He also plays guitar.
I've got that riff in my head from the Sick Inside, that down, 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 down. Very cool, man.
Thank you.
I just came back to Seattle. I was in Pennsylvania for a while. I wanted to get back into some local podcasting, and I came across your video, Sick Inside, and I'd actually been slightly familiar with the Young Pioneers. I remember, nope, we'll get to that, and the Tropicana thing, and Scott Vanderpool, mm-hmm. and all that stuff, but Sick Inside, I heard, and I'm a pop fan, and I feel like my ears perk up when I hear good pop music, and man, These melodies, the chord progression, just really, in my opinion, deserve to exist. Very cool, very kind of timeless in a sense. And I was struck by the video as well. I'm familiar with Shannon Perry, the woman who's in it. And love her work and her wild tattoos and whatnot.
Yeah.
So I don't know. For whatever reason, I played it. I loved it. Tell me a little bit about that song, first of all.
Well, it was a song that Chris wrote and he brought to us, and we had been sort of, you know, we usually bring an idea that's somewhat loose, and Chris had words and the music, and then he and Scott were working out the vocal harmonies, and then we were laying down some demos, just recording them in the studio, and I felt that it was really kind of missing something, and I had always loved the sound of Wichita Linemen, and I'm not a very accomplished guitar player, but I do like really like the tones and sounds of things. So that's why I started developing that guitar line in there, which I felt really kind of finished the song.
Tied it together.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Gave it some distinction that was a little more unusual than what you would hear.
Now before that, otherwise, was it just the keys and the bass line and
keys
maybe strumming?
Bass line it's kind of got this weird open A that's just played on the two low strings of the guitar.
Okay.
That kind of give it that dun, 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 dun. And we really kind of had that. And it's Chris and Scott are playing off of each other in the harmonies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the song was developing along.
As the two vocalists. Chris
as the
and
two
Scott.
Vocalists, yeah. Okay. You know, Scott's a drummer, but he's got just this really great timing for harmonies. And
yeah.
He's such a natural singer. It's, you know, it's really lovely to have him.
Has he always filled that role out in the Young Pioneers?
Well, you know, when we were...
Scott Vanderpool.
Scott Vanderpool, the drummer. Originally, I would write songs for Scott to sing, and he would sing lead on a lot of, you know, maybe a third of the material.
Okay.
But since we've been playing again, he really loves his role, coming up with harmonies and whatnot. And
I'm guessing maybe he's not. Actually, I don't know. Is he musically trained, as it were, classically trained, or that type
you know?
Of thing?
I mean, all of us as young people in our teens had lessons, because I think all of us were really tuned into music when we were kids, little kids.
Yeah, for sure. And harmonies, and learning how things worked. And...
Well, even, you know, for me more so, I was never very good. I'm still not a very good musician in terms of, like, my guitar playing ability. But as a kid, I was just obsessed with music. And it was in the 70s and weird music. I was... You know, I loved rock and roll, and punk rock came along, and it basically said, you don't have to be good, right. You just have to love it. And all
right.
of a sudden, I'm like, I want to be that, I want to do that, and I started meeting people in Portland, and that's what really kind of brought me into it. And I think all of us, Chris and Scott and Brian, who was our original bass player, and Colm, who's playing keyboards with us, all of us kind of came from that place, and all the rest of the Pioneers were much better musicians than me,
right.
But I could bring some originality
and composition, right?
Yeah, well, I'm mostly, yeah, songwriting and that sort of thing.
People talk about amazing guitar players. You know, you might go to Nashville, and obviously there's some great songwriters there, but, like, let's say you see a bar band, they're playing three chords, and they're just tearing it up. Nothing terribly original about the three chords, but they can play really well. There's different ways to be good, I think, you know,
mm-hmm.
whether you can play well or not. Like the composition, the songwriting, if you have a knack for that, to me, it's a very powerful thing. And I feel like that's maybe where you're coming from a little bit.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, certain of us are... creative people, and I've kind of never fit into the regular world because of that.
Right.
And I, for my job, I design things, and music has always been about the songwriting part. I mean, Chris and I are very prolific. We write a lot of songs and a lot of music, and we go through it quickly. And then the songs that are working stick, and the ones that don't just get archived. But
we
put together a lot of material. I think that's kind of the funnest part, is just working on new things.
I think that's a sign of a really good creative process, if you're having fun working on new things. I think that's what it's all about, for sure.
It's weird. I thought, you know, we would hit a certain age, and I didn't play music for a long time after the Pioneers broke up originally. I mean, I played in Sun Velvet Sidewalk and some other Olympia bands, and I played with Kathleen Hanna briefly in a thing called Viva Knievel. And then
I saw some Velvet Sidewalk once. Yeah. About 97?
That was much after I had left. Okay. Yeah. I was playing in 91 with Al, yeah. But, you know what? I got into other creative things, and I kind of felt like, you know, maybe I was done with music, but Chris and Scott were always playing and always doing different things. And when I called Chris up and I said, you know, I kind of feel like getting together with you guys and playing music, I didn't think that we would be writing anything new. I didn't know if I even had that in me anymore. I just thought, well, let's just screw around and see what comes up. And then we started writing songs, and in a way I feel like we write better, more interesting, funner songs now than we did when we were younger. It was a lot harder when we were younger, I think.
Yeah, what do you think the reason for that might be?
Well, as a young person, is it cool? Are people going to like this? Are they going to like me? And now it's like, I don't give a shit about any of that. I am just happy, like, creating this thing, and do we like it? You know?
The irony is that's what will oftentimes make you cool.
Exactly. But as a young person, I could never see that.
Get past it, yeah.
And, you know, I remember, like, not being able to write a single song for 6 months and trying to write a song.
Yeah.
Whereas now it just, like, I sit down for 45 minutes and just start playing around with something, and then it starts to come, and I, like, make a little recording of it and listen to it, and then I just start hearing the words come in.
It all fleshes itself out in a sense over time.
And then you bring it to these people that have known you for your whole adult life, and then we all start adding parts to it and arranging it, and it starts to become, it has its own life, and it's really fun to share that with people that just know you so intimately.
Do you feel like you like to keep it simple and loose in the initial stages and kind of let it do its own thing?
Absolutely. Sometime Chris or I will show up and we'll have this really, like, distinct idea. Like, we'll want you to play it this way. And then there'll be this friction in the band because people, of course, want to come up with their own thing. But we've known each other for so long that you're going to try it out. And then it's going to end up, either you're playing that part and you're finally hearing what they're trying to get you to do, or you pull them out of the, you know, I'm pulled out of the thing that I was, like, stuck on.
Right.
But eventually it's just going to be what it's going to be.
That's true. I've had to, like, replace guitarists. I play music as well. I tried to replace a guitarist a couple times. And it's such an impossible task to ask that person or something, mm-hmm. like, hey, can you play this other line? They can never play it. Like, you got to do your own thing, basically.
And right now we have a new bass player.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yes. Nathan, who has known all of us for a very long time, just ended up with some work conflicts. He lives in Olympia. He wasn't going to be able to get Saturdays off anymore to play shows, and so he was bowing out. And we have this woman, Sasha Parks, playing with us currently, and we just had a few rehearsals, but it seems to be fleshing out, and I think she's going to be a good fit.
Sasha Parks?
Yeah.
Full-time bass player?
Yeah.
Nice. Now, your video is very cool. You featured local woman, Seattle woman, Shannon Perry. Tell me a little bit about that. How'd you get to know her? How'd she get in it?
I have another role as, I don't know how else to put this, kind of a parental figure to young creative people that, you know, are lost in the world. And I, you know, I help people in varying degrees. And Shannon, in her early 20s, was just a powerhouse of creativity, but in a lot of different directions. And
she was in Butts.
And before that, Katharine Hepburn's Voice. But when I first met her, she just worked at this coffee shop, and I would see her in my mornings before going to work. And, you know, she had dated some other young people that I knew at the time. But we kind of became friends, and then at a difficult time. We, you know, she started sort of seeking me out for some help, and I work with a lot of young people in that way. And we just really deepened a friendship, and she is probably one of the most amazing artists that I have met of, like, all of the young people I know. Just whatever she's working on, I always find just absolutely amazing.
She certainly has seemed to have taken the plunge, gone for whatever she's gone for, man.
Well, and, you know, the best part is in her, you know, she worked through that difficult period, but she never gave up on herself. Like, some people, they get tired of it, and they're like, yeah, I'm an artist, but I think I'm going to be a real estate agent, you know?
Right.
Or whatever.
I'm going to hate my life, but I'm going to do this.
Yeah, and I used to be an artist, but I do this now. And, you know, she just dove in with both feet.
To the tattoo thing.
Well, that and the music and pretty much
and
whatever
gazebos,
she was
right.
working on at the time. And I just have always been impressed with her tenacity to really live her own life. And then the tattooing thing kind of blossomed for her. And then, of course, her band thing took off because you knew it would, because she's so amazing. And just getting to, like, be a part of her life as she had this discovery and you know, the world's finally catching up and realizing just how great she is. And I had been rolling around ideas of what we wanted to do for the video, and I kind of wanted to just animate some of her illustrations, but we were going to just do these pans of her tattoos and do some animations of that, and a mutual friend was going to do all of that work, and then he ended up moving to Los Angeles, and so I had this other friend, Ann Fogarty, and she's like, well, I've got this different idea, but maybe we can combine the two. And then it was just kind of a blend of Chris Pugh and myself and Ann sort of working this thing up, and Shannon was really great and patient, where she just kind of became the person of the video.
It's a great video.
Oh, thank you.
It reminded me of, I swore to myself I wouldn't mention Nirvana in this thing, but there was this movie that just put out about Kurt and his diaries and everything, but the artwork reminded me of that, of the certain things they were doing in that movie, and very, very cool. It's not the same guy, obviously. What's his name? Do you know the guy who did that movie?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah,
I used to know. It slipped my mind. Awesome. Sounds like you're a fan of Shannon Perry for sure.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I didn't know she was in Katharine Hepburn's voice. I remember that band though.
I still have a lot of that music.
Really?
Can send you some
I'd love to hear
of that. Yeah.
Go check it out. Now, along with this song, Sick Inside, this single, you obviously, have you put together an entire record?
We finished a recording, an LP at K. We recorded it on a 16 track. It's all on tape. It's all done old school.
It's all finished.
Calvin Johnson produced it along with us.
What's that like working with him?
We've all known each other for a very long time, since the Tropicana days and before. As a matter of fact, the first Beat Happening record was recorded in the Young Pioneers practice room.
I love Beat Happening.
By Greg Sage from the Wipers.
Love the Wipers.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Greg Sage, like, rolled into town or something in a van, recorded it, and left like a cowboy. I saw some interview, and that's how they described the scene.
Well,
I don't know if that's true.
Calvin borrowed somebody's 4-track.
Okay.
And they set up, we were rehearsing in this old fire station that the fire district wasn't using anymore, and they were available to people at the college for practice rooms. And Tom Robinson from Portland had a couple of really great microphones that Greg brought up, and Calvin had got this 4-track quarter-inch deck, and Greg just amazing the way he could capture just using the room and using the way they were playing their instruments to put that record together. It's still my favorite Beat Happening record.
What's the name of that first record?
Is there a name to it? It's the very first one.
Is it just Beat Happening? Oh, okay. I love Greg Sage and the Wipers. Yeah. I wonder what happened to that dude. I want to go down to Arizona and interview him or something.
You know, I'm still friends with Pat Baum and Katie and Kim from the Neo Boys.
Okay.
And Pat said that she'd recently got in touch with Greg, and we were going to get together last time I was in Portland and talk about it. But I guess he's doing well, and, you know, he's still doing Xeno Records, doing mail order stuff and downloads and stuff like that. So cool. I know he's still there. I haven't got to see him. He and I were really close, you know.
You and Greg?
Up until the early 90s, and we just lost touch. But
what's interesting, Cat?
You know, like probably one of the best record producers I could say.
Yeah.
On the planet, and it's sad that he's not doing that.
I just love watching old footage of the Wipers, and mm-hmm. it's so powerful and so raw, at least some of that early stuff. I heard later it changed a little bit.
I gotta say, I felt like by the late 80s, it was really losing its intensity. About the time Brad Nash and Brad Davidson left the band, it just didn't have that intensity anymore. You know, I think Greg was changing. He was getting into different aspects of the music, but, you know, after Youth of America came out, I put together the show in Olympia, and the Wipers came up and played, and we opened up for them, and Calvin, awesome. Before he had Beat Happening together, it was Calvin, Laura, and Heather, and we just rented a empty storefront and we did this show, and just probably one of the most intense, you know, hour-long sets I'd ever seen anybody do. I mean, the Wipers at that time in 83 were just, I mean, it was like a drill right into your brain.
Super influential on the local scene back then?
Oh, absolutely.
I know later couple really famous bands covered their stuff, but obviously before that they were on a punk level, on a very small level, huge.
Well, I went to high school in Portland, and Portland had this really great punk rock scene, and in the late 70s, you know, it was, I mean, I was...
Did you know Fred Cole?
Yeah, as a matter of fact.
Love that guy.
I was...
Tootie Cole. I've interviewed Tootie a couple times.
Yeah.
She's great.
Well, my story about Fred is Fred and Tootie had this...
Of Dead Moon, by the way.
had this record store called... and they were in the Rats at the time.
Yeah.
But they had this music store called Captain Wizeagle's in downtown Portland. And I was kind of on the outs with my folks, and my mother was not in... Like, I was failing in school, but I was really into rock and roll. And so I started building a guitar and wood shop because she was, like, not going to help me out there. And Fred helped me order a guitar neck from the Fender Company. And then I built this body and wood shop. And then Fred just so patiently helped me build my first electric guitar.
He's a total craftsman, right?
Well, I mean... Dude just loves rock and roll. I don't think they had a single guitar in there that was like a Gibson Les Paul or a Fender Stratocaster. Everything was just some weird off-brand copy or a weird off-brand guitar or bass. And Fred loved every bit of it. Like, just that guy just dripped with enthusiasm for whatever was going on. And, you know, at the time, it's like wiring a guitar, it's just like, it just looks so scary to me.
And he just did it.
He just took me through the whole thing, and, like, he was just so patient and so fun, and you know, over the years we played a lot of shows with you know, Fred and Tootie, you know, the Rats, you know, then became, you know, Dead Moon, and they were just always such high energy people to play with. I mean,
it's amazing, dude. Amazing stories. Holy shit, you've seen some history. You've been there for that history. You're part of it. Now back to Calvin Johnson. Yeah. He recorded your record, mm-hmm. and how did he get the sounds? Is it live? Is it laying down, you know, drums first, bass? How does he do it? What's going on with that?
You know, Calvin's dream, I think, is that he gets everything separated in the studio, but that we play it all at once.
I heard he likes to also create a mood in the studio. Is that accurate?
Definitely.
Yeah.
We all wear lab coats, and it is the Dub Narcotic studio.
Right.
And there's certainly a vibe that carries on. But, you know, we sat down and with intensity put together the songs, recorded them at once. And, you know, some of it was hard to come back and overdub. There's definitely some bleed through on the drums a little bit. But I feel like it was that looseness and that irreverence to, like, sort of modern isolation,
right.
that Calvin doesn't give a shit about that stuff.
Right.
He's like, this is rock and roll. We just make it, you know?
Yeah. Don't be too precious with it.
And there isn't a piece of equipment there that was made, I think, before 1970.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No, it just all, you know, old tube preamps and wow. limiters. And, I mean, I'm exaggerating. There's a few solid-state things that were a little bit later, but...
Or nothing made after 70.
Right. And, but this combination of this thing, and it's there's no, like, oh, pulling up this computer module that mimics the sound of, you know, the 60... tape right. machine. It actually is a tape
it's
machine,
what it's supposed
to be. You could imagine, you know, we patch together the path that you want the music to, the effects that you want it to run through, and when, you know, we were doing the final mix downs, it's four different people, like, manning a different fader on the board, and instead of all of that just sort of being automated on a computer, it's all done by hand.
It's a performance. It's another performance.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And with all of us involved. And then coming down and, you know, we laid some more vocal tracks down. Even attempted to have a typewriter on one of the songs. That didn't really work out. But, you know, I mean, there was a certain amount of playfulness and experimentation that could go into that.
That's awesome. One of my favorite records is A Lonesome Crowded West by Modest Mouse. And he did that one.
Mm-hmm.
The energy is unbelievable. Like, I can't wait to hear your Young Pioneers record. We'll get to future plans in a second, but I wanted to take it back a little bit. I had heard about there's a club in Olympia we talked briefly mm-hmm. a little bit ago called the Tropicana. And tell me a little bit about that. And did you open it up? Did you do a reunion show for the Tropicana? And did that spring forth the Young Pioneers reunion? Or how did all that work together?
You want me to start at the beginning? Does it matter?
Wherever.
No.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, the beginning.
You know, we did this show in Olympia with the Wipers. And then...
The one you talked about
before.
Yeah,
that I just talked about, you know, in 83. And everyone's like, hey, well, what are you going to do next week? And I'm like... We were just doing that show, you know. And this other guy, Larry Roberts, who some of us were going to school with at the time, he's like, well, maybe I could put the money together for us finding a club. And at the time, Olympia's downtown was completely devoid of businesses. The only stuff that was going were out in the suburbs at the shopping malls. And downtown was just a ghost town. So we found a storefront that would work and a landlord that was receptive.
Is it Fourth Avenue?
Right on Fourth Avenue.
Okay.
And we signed a year-long lease. And then...
What'd you pay for that per month?
I think the rent was about $370 a month. It might have been less. It might have been $350 or something like that, mm-hmm. plus utilities, which at the time seemed like so much money. But it took us a while. The city made us put in like wheelchair accessible bathrooms that we just did on the total fly. But it was amazing the people that showed up that helped do the work. But we basically got the space fireproofed and got approved for, I think our occupancy was 80 people. And there were times when we had, you know, 150, 200 people in that tiny space.
Amazing.
But we got open. I think Beat Happening and the Young Pioneers played the first show that we opened up with. And then we proceeded to have the Butthole Surfers came through twice. Jody Foster's Secret Army, Black Flag, Greg Sage.
Slayer.
Slayer. I actually, you know, we were playing shows at the Metropolis in Seattle, and Hugo Poitin, the owner, was doing some promotion. He's like, hey, Brad, I got this metal act out of L.A. We want to do a show down there. And I'm like, okay, let's do it, you know? We're into all sorts of stuff. And we got this, you know, we got this stage that we built, and you could fit easily a 5-person punk rock band with a 4-piece drum set. And then these guys show up, and these drum sets are huge. I mean, they've got dozens of drums. So we had...
Is that Dave Lombardo?
We had two opening acts and Slayer. And, I mean, a semi wouldn't have carried those three drum sets. And unlike, like, with us...
So there's three metal bands from L.A.?
One metal band from L.A. Slayer. And then two local bands.
Okay. They just had a lot of drums.
Their drummer had their own elaborate drum set.
Right.
And of course, like the punk rock bands, everyone's going to share equipment, and there'll be one drum set on the stage the whole night that gets beat to shit. These guys, they got to have their own drum set.
For sure. Well, so, Dave Lombardo is one of the most awesome speed metal drummers of all time, and his kit's like 100 pieces. When we were in high school, we would talk about it, and you're like, man, Dave Lombardo can play all 100 pieces in 10 seconds, man. It's amazing. You know? So.
Well, it really was that way. And anyway, we ended up setting the rest of the band on the floor, and the drums just filled the whole stage.
The stage was the drum throne.
The stage was the drum throne. And we didn't have a ton of people show up. I think we had like 40 people show up, and they just killed it.
Yeah, I bet.
They just killed it.
Well, I listened to it's on YouTube. I listened to the performance, the Slayer performance. Yeah, it sounded great. The sound quality was kind of iffy, but the performance was there.
It's hard for people to know, like, just how hard it was to get a decent recording then.
Right.
You know, now you record something on your phone, it's got all of these digital limiters and gates, and it just, any recording on my phone sounds great, but when you think about, like, us recording something on a little cassette recorder or something, and the tape hiss, and the...
Distortion.
Everything's blowing out the...
Right.
You know, there's just no way. About the only way that you could do it, like, we used to set a recorder up outside our practice room down the hall, and it was just about perfect.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I did hear a couple decent recordings from Tropicana. There was Fang.
Oh, yeah. Fang was a great show.
Seemed good.
Oh, yeah.
Seemed all right. Yeah, seemed great.
Well, there was a stretch there where one of our sound guys, John Hinkle, he had a great PA.
Yeah.
And he had some really great microphones. And when John was running sound, he would record a cassette off of the board, and all of those were fantastic.
Yeah.
No,
okay.
He was really...
That would have been the Fang, maybe?
Yeah. Okay. He did about 2/3 of the show, and then we had this other guy think his name was Ryan. And it's funny because he had this PA because he was the sound guy for this Yes tribute band.
Nice.
And they hadn't been doing anything forever. He was sitting on this PA, and before we opened the Tropicana, he's like, I want to be the Young Pioneers sound guy. And wherever we would do a show, he would come set up this really great PA. And wow. We, you know, if we were playing a Grange somewhere or something, and it was awesome. And then he was doing some of the Tropicana shows, and then right about mid-84, Yes put out some crazy record, and he's like, sorry, Brad, we're getting the band back together.
The Yes tribute band.
Yeah. And he ends up disappearing, you know. So, and then John was pretty much our sound guy doing all the shows from that part on. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the tape that that I heard on YouTube, and it didn't seem to have a title, but it's just the Young Pioneers.
That was the first Young Pioneers cassette, and a couple of the songs were songs that Chris Pugh recorded himself.
Okay.
And then the rest were ones that we recorded on the 4-track out at Evergreen. And then there might have been one that we recorded on just on a cassette player in our practice room, as I recall.
I was struck by kind of everything about the cassette. I didn't know what to expect. It looked super lo-fi, but, you know, just the picture and the cover on YouTube. But I listened to it, and, man, the guitar work, jangly, cool, kind of surfy.
Mm-hmm.
The harmonies, very cool. At some point, I was totally entranced. I don't know, third or fourth song in, about 15 minutes into it. It was like just these couple great vocal harmonies. I was like, holy shit, I think you guys are really onto something cool, man. I can see why it had so much resonance to get it back together, you know? And now you're doing your debut LP.
Yeah, I know. You know, there is a, there are a couple of songs that Greg Sage recorded in the mid-80s. Chris was in Europe at the time, and Brian and I and Scott Vanderpool, Greg just had some extra studio time.
Oh, a couple Young Pioneer songs.
Yeah.
Greg Sage. Oh, wow.
And Calvin's sitting on that tape, but because Chris wasn't on it, we never released it. But Greg did a brilliant job recording those songs.
I'm sorry, so who's singing on it then?
Scott does all the singing on it.
Where's that stuff? Is it ever going to be released?
Calvin's got it.
Calvin's got it.
Yeah.
Well, Calvin, if you're listening,
I might be able to make arrangements for you to hear some of that stuff.
I would love that.
I know. Calvin always teases me that we should put that out. But
how many songs are in that little?
Three, I think.
Three? Wow. Yeah. Put it out as a little 7-inch.
I know. Well, you might someday.
That'd be tight, man.
Yeah. And then there's some live stuff that we recorded in 84 at this party, this outdoor party out in a field. And I think that's up there. It might be. If not, I think it's on our SoundCloud page.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's a pretty good representation of the stuff that we were doing back then. We've actually got our whole second record ready to start. So we're really anxious to... We're putting this one out on vinyl. It's going to be called High Again.
High Again, yeah. On K Records.
On K Records.
And when's that coming out?
Late spring.
Okay. That's going to be killer. And is it very similar to Sick Inside? Same kind of feel? A lot of it?
Yeah. We still kind of go a little bit in different directions. Mm-hmm. We have one song that we had, it's called Ripwad. It's an instrumental that we recorded, that we wrote all together back in 83. And that's the only old song that's on the record.
Ripwad.
And then all the other songs are new ones that we've written. And when we play in Olympia, it's kind of hard for us to play our old stuff because we're really, of course, into our new stuff. But we still play a mix of it.
Did you go down there and do another show at the Tropicana and resurrect it, or...?
Well, we did.
Last year?
We did a, was that 15-year reunion back in the like early 2004, I think. And then we just did the 30-year reunion summer before last. It was a year late, but...
That's how I remember that.
Yeah.
I've been gone the past year, but I remember when I was here. Yeah. That happening and all that.
No, that was a lot of fun. And...
was it at the same... or just a different store or a different place?
Well, in Olympia? The first reunion, we were actually able to play in... It's funny, because this... there was a Christian organization that really couldn't stand the Tropicana. As a matter of fact, they would have prayer vigils outside on Saturday nights. I think they thought we were Satan worshiping or something, and, you know, polluting the minds of the youths. But we...
that's funny.
You ever heard of this this German industrial band called White House?
No.
Okay. Super crazy, and our friend...
I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, this was back in the 80s. Anyway, he had set up this show with White House and convinced them to come all the way to the United States, all the way to Olympia to play this show, and the people from the Christian organization were so appalled at what was going on, they actually came inside, and there was like this... kind of religious confrontation in front of the stage, which all made great theater for everybody. Yeah. But anyway, shortly after that, the city convinced the landlord not to renew our lease. So Tropicana was done in a year.
The whole thing happened in a year. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, at that first reunion, we actually got into the space. You know, somebody next door had bought the building. They completely redid it to be this kind of, like, dinner theater or something. And it didn't even last a week. And then it sat empty for another, you know, 15, 20 years.
Wow. Where is it on 4th Avenue in Olympia?
I'm going to say almost right across the street from the East Side Club. I think on Adams and 4th. Yeah.
Okay. Now, philosophically, back then, what was the temperature like? I mean, were people trying to make money? I mean, was there careerism involved? Oh, was there any thought of that whatsoever?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not.
They're just, you know, somebody as big as X, who were, I think, when you read about it now, they were just so disappointed they couldn't crack mainstream music.
X.
Yeah. I mean, somebody that big.
Yeah.
And for people like us, Portland bands, Olympia, Seattle, you know, we were, like, to me, the best you were ever going to do is you might put out a single to critical acclaim and sell, you know, maybe 2,000 singles, most of which you gave away. And really, that's all you ever needed it to be.
There was no talk of a musical revolution coming out of Olympia, and nothing.
No, and, you know, Calvin had a radio show.
Because it did eventually.
And I had a radio show.
Chaos Records.
Right?
Or Chaos.
Chaos. And then Bruce Pavitt had a radio show in Seattle. And, you know, you were just, we just lived in this world, and there was, you know, it was always a money-losing venture.
Right. Sure.
You know, and really we were just looking to bond with other people that loved this weird genre of music. And when you listen to all of that music, it's all totally different from itself.
Right.
It was just really more of a spirit than it was, you know. It wasn't like we were all country bands playing country music. There were punk rock bands that played country, and there were punk rock bands that played surf, and punk rock bands that played blues, and everything in between. It was never going to amount to anything, and I feel like...
It's just an amazing hobby, and there's freedom in that.
Well, it wasn't
even
a hobby, it was our lives. I mean, it was the most important thing.
Hobby as far as, like, people who have real careers go. Yeah.
Right.
But I understand.
You know, if you look at I get the notice that we all get from Social Security, you know, that shows your work history. And yeah. I have this blank spot in my life that's through that stretch that there just wasn't, you know, that's what I was doing. It was so important to
There's
me.
There's so many people in this country, in this world, that have no idea what that's about. And that's kind of bizarre.
No, and it's really bizarre.
Because they turned 18, 20, got their job, put in 20 years and whatever.
Well, it's kind of that way again. And the crazy thing was is, like, this is perking along, and Bruce Pavitt, who was in Olympia originally but then was in Seattle.
He's a total visionary.
Yeah, you know, and he's just kind of marching along doing this thing. And, you know, he and Calvin, they put these record labels together, and, you know, they're selling records and getting involved in distribution not to make money. They just love it. You know,
yeah.
It's so important to
spread the good word.
And for Bruce, I got to say, that whole world domination thing was really kind of a joke and a thumb in the eye to the industry. Like, it was never going to go anywhere until, you know,
Geffen bought out Nirvana's contract.
Well, it's weird. I was at Bruce's house and, you know, Mudhoney was doing really well, and I think Mark Arum and I and Tad and some other folks were there, and we were there just having a barbecue, and Bruce and Jonathan had all of these test pressings from, you know, these records that they were going to put out. And
this is the initial batch of Sub Pop.
Just the initial batch, and I'm sitting in Bruce's backyard, and someone throws on the Nirvana test pressing for Bleach. And,
great record.
And I'm just like, oh my God, what is this? That is so good. You know, and I'd been listening to the single.
Yeah.
And
Love
Floyd.
Buzz.
Yeah. And yeah. Floyd the Barber and Love Buzz. And it just, this just, like, I had never, like, I had seen Nirvana a bunch of times at house parties, but this just, like, totally turned my head. And I'm like,
it's amazing how certain bands live. They're a little scrappy, a little not so professional,
mm-hmm.
but somehow they can turn it into gold on a recording. I feel like Beat Happening may have been a little that way. I feel like the
totally
White Stripes
way.
Are that way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, and the opposite of that was Mudhoney. You'd go see them live, and it was like Scratch Acid or something. It would just blow your mind. Mudhoney was so great live, and they couldn't quite capture it. On a record. Like, the record would never do their live show justice.
What is that?
I don't know. But, you know, I felt like Sonic Youth was always better on records than
okay.
they were live.
Okay. Yeah.
But, you know, it's weird. You know, you're right. I heard, you know, it was just, there was a stretch there where, like, my life had really come apart, and then I kind of got cleaned up, and I moved back to Olympia in 89. And I was, you know, spending a lot of time with my Olympia people, and Kurt Cobain was living there with his girlfriend Tracy at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd have a barbecue on Friday with a group of friends, and I kind of got to know Kurt then.
Nice guy.
Great guy.
Normal guy?
No, never going to be normal. But abnormal in this way that you would think Calvin Johnson would be, or anything.
Sure.
Kind of a savant, you know. Somebody
yeah,
that's just really,
slightly strange.
Yeah, which is the best part about the
eccentric.
People that I enjoy, eccentric people. And, you know, at that time, nobody that anything is doing in my music world is ever amounting to anything financially. It just wasn't a part of it. And to me, I guess the saddest point is, you know, Love Buzz comes out, and then we all had cassettes of the demo for Smells Like Teen Spirit, and we all knew that this was going to be a really huge record.
Mainstream huge.
Well, I didn't know at the time,
right.
but I knew it was, like, phenomenal. Like,
okay.
the songwriting, the way the songs were put together. And
yeah. drumming.
Yeah. And then that, you know, because Bleach was so good.
Yeah.
You know, already they sort of Nirvana vastly surpassed all the other, to me, the other sub-pop acts, just in terms of songwriting and arrangement.
And that wasn't so obvious just from watching them live, necessarily?
Not to me.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm a little slow that way, maybe. But then, you know, and after Bleach did so well, Nirvana was the one that really wanted to jump ship on sub-pop.
Right.
And I just saw the whole world kind of turn upside down, but frankly, you know, Nirvana opened the door for all those really great bands, you know, Hole, and I mean, the first records by them, and, you know,
Pretty on the Inside, I believe.
Yeah, L7, and, you know, Soundgarden, and those first major releases of Soundgarden were just phenomenal. It was a completely different sound from what other people were doing, but, you know, and the Screaming Trees, you know.
Screaming Trees. What about the Melvins, man?
Well, you know, the Melvins,
they just, like, kept with their craft. They're still doing it. They're making a living. They're amazing. Well, people love the Melvins.
Well, it's funny because the Melvins' first shows were at the Tropicana.
The Melvins are like Frank Zappa to me. Yeah. Like, I understand people love it. Mm-hmm. I would love to get into it, and I kind of can, mm-hmm. but I'm not quite there.
Well, from the get-go, they went their own route. Like, they played a shredding punk rock show for their first debut at the Tropicana.
Is that on YouTube? Because I heard something. It was amazing.
I think those are on. Have you listened to those first cassette compilations from Kay?
No.
Tommy Majors put out Let's Together. And, like, there's three cassette compilations that you can find on YouTube.
I've got a couple of the more modern Calvin Johnson cassette comps, but he used to do it back in the day.
Oh, yeah. These came out in 83, 84.
These are official K releases?
These are official K releases.
Okay.
Cassette only.
Oh, wow.
Because that's
Let's Together?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then Let's See, and then there's one other one.
Wow.
And you will find the Refusers, you'll find the Melvins. But the thing is that the first Melvins show I see, they're just playing blazingly fast. The second one I see, Buzz is like, well, Brad, we're really getting into metal. We're going to be more of a metal band.
Yeah.
And by the third time I see them, everything's slowed down.
I heard they slowed down everything.
Oh, no, just like...
to fuck with people, almost.
Well, no, it's what they were really into.
All right.
And Dale is such a phenomenal drummer, and Buzz just has this creative, like, genius behind what they are. It was never going to be accessible in a way that a Chris Cornell or, you know...
But it's built for the long haul, perhaps.
Well, they're just... And the thing is like Frank Zappa, that music, it isn't appealing to every single person on the planet, but to these 500 people, that's all they want. And they don't understand why the rest of the world doesn't realize how brilliant that is.
I'm that way with a modern guy named Ariel Pink.
I don't know him.
He's a total genius. Rubs people the wrong way. I love him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I still... And the thing is every time the Melvins, you know... We lost the Tropicana, then there was Gesco, then there was Reco Muse, and the Melvins would guarantee sell the place out with people standing outside watching the show.
They're from Aberdeen, originally,
right? They're from Aberdeen, but man, I'm telling you, and you'd have like the normal like alternative punks there, but then you'd have all of these like people praying at the altar of metal. You know, there'd just be this huge crossover audience for them.
Right.
Every time, you know. They really had this draw to these different channels of music in a way. They really crossed over.
That's great. So looking back, I think you and your scene helped set that whole thing up. The whole Nirvana, the whole explosion in the mainstream, and that's amazing. What blows your mind about it? I mean, do you think about it and think, Holy shit. Because how are you going to be so lucky to be there at that right time, you know?
You know,
I know a guy named Stan Dunster who's in Danger Mouse briefly.
Yeah, I know Stan.
Yeah, yeah. I worked with him at Ed Cobbler. He was in my band and all this stuff. But
Stan's a great guy.
Yeah.
And
but how amazing is that to be part of that, man? What's your thoughts on that?
But that whole thing was
lay the roots down in Olympia.
But that whole thing was made out of real people.
For sure.
And the sad thing is I'm just going to say it, I just felt like when the world caught on to Kurt came apart, you know? He just, like, started acting like a rock star in a way that...
Because he felt he had to appeal to the whole world, in a sense, or no? Or
who knows? You know, frankly, same thing would have happened to me at 26, probably, you know?
24 for him, I
guess. Yeah, I wouldn't know how to even begin to behave. You know, I was a little bit older than Kurt by the time all of this was blown up. I was 28 and kind of on a very different path.
Right.
But, you know, it's weird. I moved back to Seattle and I was working and I was playing less and less music and doing sort of more and more sort of regular things. I moved to Philadelphia for a little while.
Nice.
But I come back to Seattle, and it's, you know, the grunge thing is off the hook.
Oh, this is in the early 90s.
This is in the early 90s, and I'm at my coffee shop, and, you know, this guy's like, hey, Brad, this is the last day you'll see me. You know, my I just sold the publishing for, and I'm telling you, they were a shitty, stupid band. I just sold the publishing for my band for $30,000. This at the time, $30,000 is probably more money than I had made in my working career up to
prior,
that point.
Yeah.
You know, and the major record labels are just showing up to Seattle and writing people checks.
So this is a guy who nobody would have heard of after that, but had just come to some gold rush.
Well, not only that, they're just sort of mimicking what they think people are interested in. There's no content there worth,
right.
You know, and granted, we all do that to some extent, you know. I mean, my early music career was mimicking stuff that I liked. It was just, I was so bad at it, it would become its own thing.
I heard a little Athens, Georgia influence from, and maybe that's totally off, I'm a huge REM and B-52s fan. I kind of heard a little bit of that in what you were doing and maybe what the Young Pioneers, any truth to that?
Well, you know, people would compare us to REM, but I never really listened to them until someone said, hey, you guys kind of sound that way.
A little jangly.
And yeah, and then I started, you know, I listened to more of it. I liked it.
I love REM.
Yeah.
Myself.
I was more obsessed with this Portland band at the time called Napalm Beach.
Napalm Beach.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
But I could never, you know, come close to what they were. They were super dark, and they were into blues. And they had the drummer from the original drummer from the Wipers, who was on the first two records.
What's his name?
Sam Henry.
Sam Henry. That's kind of known as the classic Wipers lineup.
Yeah.
Generally, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, Sam Henry and Dave Koppel were the original drummer and bass player.
So you got a record coming out next year in the springtime. It's on K Records. Follow up, the lead single Sick Inside is awesome. If I didn't like the song, I wouldn't be sitting here with you, man. I thought it was great. And it's on K Records. It's called High Again. You've already got a second record. Now, do you think that, I know it's in the future and probably shouldn't even talk about it now, but will that definitely be released, you think?
Oh yeah. No, okay. I think we're gonna have Steve Fisk produce it.
I've met him. He's a really nice guy, as far as I can tell.
Oh yeah, no, he's amazing, and
and a great producer.
And a brilliant producer.
One of the best.
And whereas with Calvin, you know, we had a lot of our involvement, for better or worse. I think with Steve, we just want to hand it off and see what he comes up with, and mostly just you know, new ways of doing things.
Try a couple different things. Well, that's great, man. I want to thank you for coming out here. This talk went to some areas I was so happy about, and so great to hear this history from you. Any parting words to our listeners here?
Just keep listening to music, and thanks for taking the time, man.
You're welcome, man.
We love making it.
Yeah, thanks, dude.
Sometimes I know what you've been thinking. I know that you've been waiting.